From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. What if someone told you there was a technology that could make bridges stronger, clean dirty water, and prevent your socks from getting stinky? Chances are you'd think that person was pulling your leg. But these are just some of the possibilities we hear when the field of nanotechnology comes up. Nanotechnology is the branch of science that deals with extremely tiny particles. Scientists want to harness these nanoparticles and use them to transform everything from cancer treatment to the way we heat our homes. But as companies work to get nanotech products on the market, there are also concerns that the field is going too far, too fast. A study released last week found that some so-called nanotubes could pose a health risk similar to that of asbestos. So, how exactly does nanotechnology work? And how do we know if we're buying products using it? And how should the public respond to this new area of science? Well, joining us to help answer all of these questions is Andrew Maynard, who is the Chief Science Advisor to the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies. That's an organization dedicated to minimizing the risks and maximizing the potential benefits of nanotechnology. Andrew Maynard joins us in the studio. Thank you very much.
Hi, good to be here.
Joining us from studios in Chicago is Sean Murdoch, who is Executive Director of the Nano Business Alliance, which represents nanotech businesses on Capitol Hill and on Wall Street. Sean Murdoch, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And joining us by telephone from Houston is Vicki Colvin, Professor of Chemistry and Director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. Vicki Colvin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew, allow me to start with you. The media often talk about nanotechnology without really explaining what it is, and studies have shown the public isn't really sure what it is either. How would you define this technology in layperson terms?
Well, that's really putting me on the spot straight off, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Vicki's soon to follow.
Nanotech is one of those things that it's hard to get a good grasp of because it means so many different things. But you boil it down to its basics, and nanotechnology is all about doing things at an incredibly small scale. So we're down at the scale of individual atoms and molecules, and we're working out how we can manipulate those, engineer those at that fine scale to do new things. Now, usually when I try and explain this to people, I use three words, and those are smallness, strangeness, and sophistication. And if you can remember those three words, you've got a pretty good idea of what nanotech is all about.
I don't think I can remember those three words. Help me out, Vicki Colvin.
Well, I think that it's small, it's strange, and it's important.
Okay, I got two of the words. Smallness and strangeness, and the third, either important or sophisticated. Sean, how many products are currently on the market that use nanotechnology? I know sunscreen, tennis rackets are the ones I tend to read about fairly often. What else?
Candidly, there isn't a census of all the products on the market that that everyone agrees to. I think Andrew and the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies has cataloged about 600 of them. Is that accurate, Andrew?
Yeah, we're up to 600 at the moment.
Is there any way for consumers to know that we're purchasing products that might contain nanoparticles?
Well, in some cases, a manufacturer will actually claim that they're using nanotechnology, so there is pretty obvious, but they don't have to do that. So there are many manufacturers out there using this technology and not really telling anybody about it, and in those cases it's pretty hard to work out whether you're using a nanotech product or not.
And Sean, are there companies that might be claimed to using nanotechnology that aren't really using nanotechnology?
Oh, certainly, and I think that is beginning to decline a little bit, but early on, anytime you have a new technology, you have a bit of a hype cycle where originally folks get very excited and expectations grow, stratospherically and really out of control. And so lots of people flock to, a new technology, and many opportunists and charlatans do as well. And so, early on, you see a lot of people come in and make those claims even when they're not substantiated. In fact, the only known issue that was a health issue that was at all associated with nanotechnology really wasn't nanotechnology. There was a product called Magic Nano over in Europe and Germany that was not nanotechnology at all and did cause some folks to go to the hospital. And so that was, you know, an example of, if you will, some folks claiming nano when it wasn't.
We're talking about nanotechnology on this Tech Tuesday and inviting you to join the conversation at 800-433-8850. Do you think nanotechnology will have a big impact on our lives? What do you think are the most promising uses for nanotechnology? The number again, 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Our nation is consumed right now with concerns over the high cost of energy, and it's my understanding there's a lot of excitement about the potential for nanotechnology to change the world of solar energy. Is that correct, Andrew?
Very much so, yes. If you look at the current ways that we harvest solar energy using very expensive solar cells, there's got to be a better way. At the moment, you need a multi-billion dollar fabrication facility to produce one of these cells. They're very expensive, very inefficient. What nanotechnology seems to be doing is creating a new way of producing really very inexpensive solar cells, and it's using a technique called printable electronics. So imagine that you had something that looked a little bit like a desk jet printer sitting on your desk, and you slid a piece of plastic in one end, and out of the other end came a solar cell. That's the sort of technology we're beginning to look at using nanotechnology.
Care to join in on that conversation, Sean?
Oh, you know, absolutely. When you look at solar energy, you know, folks have wanted broad-based solar adoption for decades now. I mean, NASA really developed the original solar cells to be used in space, in satellites, and absolutely amazing technology, very robust and reliable. And it made a lot of sense to make it the way that we have when the cost of getting up and replacing something was a couple hundred million dollars to get out into space. Unfortunately, the cost structure hasn't worked to enable broad-based, you know, development and deployment of the technology, you know, here on Earth. And so what you have with these nanotech-based approaches, as Andrew said, is a different manufacturing paradigm. It is looking at a low-cost production process that's roll-to-roll. It's a lot more similar to the way that a newspaper gets printed than to a, you know, computer chip, which is the way they're made today. And if we're going to see, you know, broad-based use of solar technology, the costs have to decline substantially, and we're beginning to see that take form right now.
Sean Murdoch is executive director of the Nano Business Alliance. That's an organization that represents nanotech businesses on Capitol Hill and Wall Street. He joins us from Chicago. Joining us in our Washington studios, Andrew Maynard, who is chief science advisor to the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, that organization dedicated to minimizing the risks and maximizing the potential benefits of nanotechnology. And joining us by telephone from Houston, Vicki Colvin is a professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. Vicki Colvin, there's a lot of discussion about nanotech's potential in helping to clean up the environment. It's my understanding that researchers at Rice have used something called nanorust to remove arsenic from water. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. It kind of works in two different ways. You know, I think one thing that you get when you make something really, really tiny, most nanomaterials, is just a lot of surface. So you can create, you know, nanoscale sponges that in a very small amount of space just have a lot of surface to stick bad stuff that might be in water. So that's one thing that is already used a lot, nanoscale materials for water treatment, because they just have a lot of surface area. The technology here at Rice also uses the fact that rust is magnetic. And so one of the challenges when you throw nanomaterials into water is that they often don't come out very easily. They're so small that they don't settle under gravity. They just sort of hang in water. So getting rid of them through a filter is complicated from a variety of perspectives, because they clog filters and it takes a lot of pressure. But if you just use a handheld magnet, you can sweep it across a glass of water and all the particles will be attracted to it, so you can pull them out quite nicely. And so you're using both the high surface area and then this very unusual magnetic property that you get on the nanoscale to, in this case, remove arsenic from water.
It's my understanding, though, that not all nanotechnology is seen as necessarily good for the environment. There are groups petitioning the EPA to ban nanosilver from consumer goods, including washing machines and baby bottles, Andrew?
Yeah.
Go
ahead, Vicki.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this actually gets back to the solar cell example, too. I mean, you know, unfortunately, new technologies are complicated, and, you know, it's never a simple story that they're all black or white. So let's take the solar cell case for nanotechnology. Some of the best materials right now for those printable solar cells are actually cadmium-based. They're cadmium selenide and other types of quantum dot systems that just have spectacularly good efficiencies, but they do contain cadmium, which is not a metal you'd want out there in the environment. So you have to really look at what do we know about the benefits we're going to get, and how can we create better solar cells or better environmental technologies generally that help us prevent, for example, the release of cadmium into the environment through some special packaging system or recycling system that we could adopt. So I think for many of these technologies, the benefits are going to be pretty obvious to people, but you're also going to be faced with the, you know, inevitable risks of whenever you use something new. And in the case of the solar cells, some not so new materials like cadmium, which we know very well and we want to keep from getting into the environment. So the reality is that if we understand enough about how the systems are getting out there and what we can do to prevent that, we have the ability to get all the benefits and really minimize the impacts.
If you've already called, stay on the line. We will get to your call on this Tech Tuesday conversation about nanotechnology. We still do have a few lines open, so you too can call 800-433-8850, or you can send your email to koju@wamu.org. We've been hearing for years about the potential of nanoparticles to treat human cancers and to deliver drugs inside the body more efficiently. How close are we to making this a reality? First, you, Sean.
Well, there's already been significant progress made, you know, trying to cure cancer. We've been working on that for decades now, and it is a complicated, difficult thing to do. Cancers are, you know, very different. But there's already some folks moving into phase one and phase two clinical trials. What people need to understand is that when it comes to, you know, new therapeutics and new drug delivery vectors, if you will, these things have to clear the FDA approval process. And so that's going to take, you know, up to 12 years, hopefully shorter in the case of some of these, to make it through. But already we've seen substantial progress, not just in the, you know, new compounds to target cancers, but in the diagnostics as well. A quick case study. Abraxane, which is made by Abraxis Oncology, is a reformulation of paclitaxel that is being used to treat cancer patients. Now, in this case, it eliminates several of the toxic solvents that we've used and greatly improves, you know, the quality of life for the folks that are undergoing chemotherapy because of all the side effects and nausea associated with those, toxic solvents. We don't yet have, you know, a cure to cancer. The National Cancer Institute, though, has talked about eliminating the pain and suffering associated with cancer, essentially making it into a treatable chronic disease by the year 2015. They're better positioned to say how we're tracking against that than I, but we are making substantial progress.
Allow me to go to the telephone. Here is Brian in Hempstead, Maryland. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was wondering if you could help me. I've actually been trying to read up on nanotechnology, and I keep coming across this concept or, I guess, reality of buckyballs. And I was wondering if you could explain those a little bit and what their application means to nanotechnology.
Andrew?
I would actually defer to Vicky. She's at the center of the buckyball universe down there at Rice University.
Well, thanks, Andrew. It's a great question. Buckyballs are in some senses really easy to visualize, because if you take a soccer ball and you put little carbon atoms at all of the points that you might see where the hexagons and pentagons come together, you'll have basically the structure of C60 or a buckyball. They were discovered here at Rice University by my late colleague Richard Smalley, Harry Croteau, and Bob Curl, who got the Nobel Prize for it in 96. It's been called the world's most beautiful molecule. And it really is a pretty spectacular molecule. And it's a molecule. As a chemist, I could certify it that way. But it's also sort of the poster child for a nanomaterial. And some of the applications for it, probably the most intuitive is that it's a little nano ball bearing. So C60 has been used in some very interesting applications as a lubricant. When you mix it in with things, because it rolls pretty well, has some very interesting chemical properties. It has the potential for being an additive to things that you want to be very smooth. And so that's one application. Some of the other applications are in medicine. A lot of cases where if you change the C16, you hang stuff off of it. Let's say maybe an antibody that recognizes a cell type you don't want to have in your body. You can use the C60 to deliver something to kill that cell. Another great application is its use in fuel cell technology to make the polymers basically work better to transport protons in those sorts of commercials where you see cars that make water out of the back. That's kind of the idea, is you need these fuel cells to work better, and C60 is one of the best additives to put in there. So it's like a lot of nanomaterials, you know, it goes from everything from medicine to fuel cell technology. So it is a pretty interesting system, and if you want to know the dimensions, it's 1 nanometer or about 10 angstroms. So it's down on the low end of a system that would be considered nano.
I knew that. But go ahead. Go ahead, please, Andrew.
Well, there's not a lot to add to what Vicky said. This is really a very unique molecule, this collection of 60 atoms of carbon. And it has a very unique chemistry, and we're just learning what we can actually do with this, how we can work with this very unusual material. And as Vicky said, there are many, many different ways we can use it.
We're going to take a short... Sean, go ahead, please.
One of the things I'd point out is, you know, at this point, really what we're talking about is exploratory research and product development. There aren't broad-based uses of C60 as yet. You know, there's a lot of work to drive down the manufacturing costs and to figure out how and where to use this product. So we're still quite early on in working with them.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation about nanotechnology on this Tech Tuesday. If you've already called, stay on the line, or you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send your email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. My producers and I are dedicated to connecting our neighborhoods with the world. By using email and call-ins, we've always set a place at the table for our listeners. Now, WAMU 88.5 is moving our conversations forward at conversation.wamu.org. Our new social network lets you suggest story ideas for the Kojo Nandi Show and engage in provocative discussions with other public radio listeners. More information is at conversation.wamu.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and the German Information Center, now celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. In 1948, the airlift created a legacy of friendship. More information is at germany.info. From Wolf Trapp Foundation for the Performing Arts, presenting Riverdance Thursday, May 29th through Sunday, June 1st. More information is available at wolftrapp.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
Mostly cloudy skies are in the forecast for the Washington region this afternoon. Showers and thunderstorms likely, a 70% chance. High temperatures expected to reach the mid-80s. It's currently 77 degrees in northwest Washington at 1225 as we return now to the Kojo Nandi Show.
It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking nanotechnology with Vicky Colvin, professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. Sean Murdoch is executive director of the Nano Business Alliance, and Andrew Maynard is chief science advisor to the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies. We go directly back to the telephones. Here is Janine in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Janine.
Hi, Kojo. How are you?
I am well.
My question is, my doctor has recommended a new regime of vitamins, and it's all nanovitamins, and I would just like your panelists to comment on what they think nanotechnology has to do with the vitamins.
Andrew?
Well, that's interesting. Thanks, Janine. We've actually been tracking the use of nanotechnology in various products, including dietary supplements and vitamins, and we've seen a surge in the number of products that use this sort of technology. What's happening here is a couple of things. First of all, I think manufacturers are discovering that if you make something really small, it's easier for the body to absorb it. So this is where the small aspect of nanotechnology comes in. So you have a vitamin that is great for you, but it's hard to get it into the body. You make it really small and it's easier to absorb. But then some companies are doing some slightly more sophisticated things, and they're actually encapsulating vitamins in like little nanometer size bubbles, which again make it easier to get those vitamins into your body. Now, exactly what the manufacturers are doing out there, it's still really hard to tell, because there's a little bit of a veil of secrecy over how some forms of nanotechnology are being used. But certainly you can see its potential for either getting good stuff into the body that's hard to get there, or even preventing bad stuff from getting into the body that you don't want to get there.
Thank you very much for your call, Janine. You too can call us, 800-433-8850. Have you purchased any products that claim to use nanotechnology or nanoparticles? And did that claim influence your decision to buy the product? You can call us at 800-433-8850. We move on to Dan in Baltimore, Maryland. Dan, your turn.
Hi. Actually, it's kind of interesting because I'm sure I've bought products that were not labeled as nano that actually probably had nanoparticles in it. I was actually wandering down the aisles of a big box store and noticed that there are now nanoparticles in some of the paints. And something that concerned me a little bit, there were previous reports about nanotitanium dioxide, which is inert and not harmful or toxic, but that when it makes it through abraded skin and suntan lotions, has been found to be cellular toxic to cells. And then I was thinking, if they're including nanotitanium dioxide in paints, 5 years down the road when all this is being sanded off and is then aerosolized, or where you have these little dust particles and inhaled, what is going to be the cellular toxicity with all the mucosal exposure and alveolar level? And I called the toxicologist at CPSC, and I said, is there any research?
That's the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, and the toxicologist said, no, basically there is no data that addresses this question, the specific question, and that basically there's no regulation in this regard, and that's basically left up to manufacturers. So I'm wondering, what is to prevent particles which are not toxic at a larger level, at a macro level, and are not known whether they are toxic at a nano level because of the possible impact on cellular walls and other issues? And what is to protect, I guess, the consumer?
You raise a number of issues, Dan, that I think all of our panelists would like to respond to. But allow me to start with Andrew, because last week, Andrew, you released a new study linking nanotechnology to cancer in a different way. I understand you found that carbon nanotubes damage the body of mice in a way that's similar to asbestos.
Very much so. Just in that context, I think it's really important to emphasize that different types of nanomaterials behave in different ways. So comparing titanium dioxide with carbon nanotubes, for instance, is like comparing chalk and cheese. Yeah. However, there is an important issue here which your caller raises, and that is things do behave differently when you make them at the nanoscale. So this comes down to the strangeness aspect of nanotechnology, if you like. So what you're seeing with carbon nanotubes, these are a really unusual formation of carbon atoms into tubes, which are only a few nanometers wide and can be tens, hundreds, even thousands of nanometers long. They show some really quite unique and incredible behavior. But of course, the question is, if you're going to create something which is a long, thin fiber in effect, is it going to behave like other long, thin fibers? And the one that always comes to mind is asbestos. Are we creating the new asbestos here? The study you referred to actually specifically asked that question, and it carried out a study that looked at the possibility of certain types of nanotubes behaving like certain types of asbestos. It wasn't conclusive, but it showed very strong indications that if people are exposed to long, thin, straight carbon nanotubes, there could be a danger of them behaving like asbestos in the lungs. So that's the danger side of it. Now, I'd love to get back to the titanium dioxide part of the question, because, of course, every material is different. And with titanium dioxide, it's almost been a poster child for nanotechnology toxicity, if you like. This is the thing that everybody studies. And they study it because at the large scale, titanium dioxide is pretty benign, doesn't really do much. But if you make it really small, it begins to behave in unusual, strange ways in the lungs. So the question is, if you make it small enough, does it become really harmful? The good news is, even though it becomes more dangerous, it's still pretty harmless stuff. The other side of this is that there is a lot of uncertainty here. So the caller mentioned what happens if it gets on the skin. And we know from most studies that if your skin is pretty healthy, it actually stays on top of the skin. There is a slight concern if you've got damaged skin that it might go through. We've actually no idea whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But there are uncertainties there because we know that things that are small behave differently.
Care to weigh in on this one, Sean Murdoch?
I think Andrew did a very nice job there. It's important to keep in mind that, you know, nanomaterials are not monolithic. There is greater diversity in nanomaterials in some sense than the traditional macroscale materials that we think about, and that they're all going to have different behavior. The studies that we've had on nanoscale zinc oxide and titanium dioxide suggest that it doesn't penetrate the skin in healthy skin in any way. So for that aspect of the question, I do want to jump real quick to the study that Andrew and the folks at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies in the UK had done, which was a good study. And it's really important work. And at the end of the day, what it's helping us do is anticipate the potential hazards associated with multi-walled carbon nanotubes. You know, to be clear on that, it was just one type of nanotube. And the good news is that, and Vicky, you probably are best positioned to comment on this, but that the predictive models worked, that it was only the long needle-like form that, in fact, had any issues associated with it, which at some level reduces our uncertainty that those predictive models are working.
And Dan, thank you for your call. Vicky, before you weigh in on this, allow me to go to Sherry in Annapolis, Maryland, who seems to have a question along similar lines. Sherry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. With respect to the long, thin nanotubes, if a is the danger, potential danger posed to humans in breathing in materials made with these long, thin nanotubes, or could it just be applying topical agents like sunscreens that contain these long, thin nanotubes? My second question has to do with that. Is there any way for the consumer to know when a material is made with long, thin nanotubes?
Vicki Colvin?
I think that the answer is we're not sure. I would say that certainly the type of study that just happened with the long thin nanotubes is one that was inspired by inhalation. So my guess is, and this is, I have to say, a guess, it's a hypothesis that is informed by the literature, is that no, you wouldn't, it wouldn't happen if you got it on your skin, and that this really requires an inhalation route. And that really remains to be tested. That's a piece of this work that still needs to unfold. I think your second question goes back to the earlier caller's point, which is a really important one, which is, do consumers know? And so the answer is no, there would be no reason that you would have information that a product you purchased might contain these materials. And so things like, you know, bicycle frames or tennis rackets could have long, thin nanofibers in them, and you would have no way of knowing that. So I think, and also when you purchase sunscreens, I can tell you kind of a good rule of thumb. If you rub it on your skin and it's clear and you read the ingredient label and it has TiO2 or zinc oxide in it, chances are it's a nanoscale material. But there really isn't any way that you would know that, because as an ingredient, what matters, at least in this country, is only composition, not size. So when you look on your ingredient labels, you don't get that size information.
For people who might have missed it, Vicki Colvin, can you repeat the ingredients, say, in sunscreen that people should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, they're good things, and I would encourage everybody to use sunscreen because you're protecting yourself against a very well-established known risk of skin cancer. But if you want to know if your sunscreen has a nanoscale particle in it, if the ingredient list says TiO2 or zinc oxide, which it would be required to by law list those as ingredients, And generally, they're active ingredients. And if you rub it on your skin, and after you rub it on, it's pretty darn clear, then the particle sizes are so small that they're not scattering visible light. And that would likely put them in the nanometer scale regime.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead, please, Sean.
If I could jump in there real quick. One of the things that's important to recognize, the Environmental Working Group evaluated over, I think it's about 700 sunscreens, and looked at the protection from UVA and UVB and what's known about the materials and their safety, and concluded that those sunscreens that contained zinc oxide and titanium dioxide were, in fact, both safe and effective, were some of the top-rated, in fact, the majority of the top-rated sunscreens in the mix. So, there's good reason that we're using these.
Andrew, how should the federal government and the industry respond to the study we mentioned earlier that you released last week?
In terms of the carbon nanotube study, I think there are three things which are very clearly needed if we're going to ensure the safety of this particular aspect of nanotechnology. The first is we've desperately got to have more research that shows us not only how exactly these carbon nanotubes might cause harm, but how we can make them safe. This study was really just the first in a series of studies. We've got to find out whether people will really be exposed to these things, whether they'll breathe them in. We've got to find out if they enter the lungs, whether they can move to the very sensitive outer side of the lungs. That is research that has got to be done, and got to be done now. And really, it's in the government's court to make sure they have a research strategy that includes that. But more than that, I think there are two other things that are needed. The first is because industry are already using this material, they need the best possible guidelines for how to use it safely. And those guidelines have got to come from government, but they've also got to be developed within industries as well, which, of course, have got to bear the brunt of any problem at the end of the day. And they can be really simple guidelines like, for instance, one recommendation has been treat this stuff like asbestos until you have better information. And then the third thing that needs to be done is we need more transparency. People need to know where this stuff is being used and how it's being used, whether that's regulators, whether it's investors, whether it's the people out on the street that are buying goods and wondering what on earth's in them.
Speaking from the investment point of view, we got an email from Ellen in Bethesda who says, I'm with an investment firm, Calvert Group, that has over $15 billion in assets. We're concerned about nanotechnology use in consumer products. We're especially worried about products with questionable societal benefits and unknown risks. We're asking consumer goods companies to make public on their websites which products contain nanomaterials, as well as safety studies, at least until the regulatory structure catches up. If some of these materials are found to be dangerous, who will be left holding the risk? How would you advise investors? Sean Murdoch?
Well, to be clear, there's been no known harm of any nanotech product out there today, and there has been research. Again, you look at the consumer products, whether it be the sunscreens and the like, as to whether the nanoparticles that are being used in these actually penetrate the skin. And they've, again, been found under normal use conditions with healthy skin not to do that. I think there's an embedded assumption in that question that these things are, in fact, hazardous and they're being used in a manner that is not safe. And there's nothing to suggest that that's the case at this point in time.
Care to add anything to that, Andrew?
Well, I think we need to be a little bit cautious. And Sean is right in what he says, that there have been no known cases of illness associated with engineered nanomaterials. But of course, what we want to do is avoid any cases of illness. So we've somehow got to be preemptive and upfront here. And I think everything we can do to enable people to make sound, sensible decisions is critically important. That involves doing the right research, but it also involves giving people the information they need. And this is where we come back to transparency. If you talk to people about what they want to know about nanotechnology, engineered nanomaterials, more than anything else, they want to know what is appearing where so they can make their own decisions.
Allow me to go back to the telephone to Chase in Clarksville, Maryland. Chase, your turn. Hi, Chase, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now.
Okay, all right, sorry about that. I was just wondering, the first time I ever heard about nanotechnology was referring to, robotics. I didn't know, I've never heard anything else about that. I didn't know if there's any kind of development on that, whether it's electrical or chemical-based or what.
John?
Yeah, sure. what some of the original folks that talked about nanotechnology, Carrick Drexler, at some level popularized the field, talking about, you know, molecular assemblers, if you will, that could make virtually anything out of virtually anything. You know, this is, you know, related back to my earlier comment about expectations and how early on our expectations tend to be overinflated in terms of what nanotechnology would do. We're moving through waves of development. The first wave of development was really tools related, because we had to be able to visualize and manipulate matter at the nanoscale to be able to, you know, make nano-enabled products. The second wave was really materials related. We're just starting to figure out how to make materials and to consistently, reliably make those materials and scale them up. What's now happening concurrently is what I'd call the application wave, and that's where you're starting to see some of the more sophisticated, higher value-added things like, you know, molecular diagnostics enabled by nanotechnology, or new cancer therapies, or new solar cells, and new memory devices and architectures. So we're now getting to that kind of device layer, and from devices we'll move into full and complete systems. And so when you look out over a 10-year window or a 20-year window, yes, we will get there, but you have to walk before you run, and we're working our way toward it.
Andrew?
Let me just add to that. It's a real come down, isn't it, when you imagine these nanometer scale robots sort of roaming the world or your body doing stuff, and then you suddenly discover that nanotechnology is nothing more than very small particles. But the reality is that when we have this ability to make very small particles and actually use them, we can do quite incredible things. I mean, as Sean said, these are building blocks that are going to change the world. It may not be very as sexy as nanobots, but it's certainly going to be world changing.
Nanobots, what, 10 years down the road?
Oh, 100 at least.
Yeah. We won't have nanobots, but we will have, you know, more device and electronics-oriented uses of these structures.
I have an email about that when we come back, but first we've got to take a short break. Chase, thank you very much for your call. You too can call us at 800-433-8850 if you'd like to join this Tech Tuesday conversation on nanotechnology. You can also shoot an email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, columnist and best-selling author Carl Hiaasen on everything from presidential politics to failing at golf, plus remembering Sidney Pollack. We revisit an interview with the iconic filmmaker who died yesterday. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
We take lessons if we want to play better tennis or golf or the piano, but what if we want to be better parents?
Usually I didn't have a lot of black friends to ask, and you can't ask a white mother how to raise your black son.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join me and the Mocha Moms as we talk about parent education programs. That's next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up today at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5. WAMU is proud to be the media sponsor for the 28th Annual Washington Folk Festival this Saturday and Sunday at Glen Echo Park in Maryland, a weekend of music, dance, storytelling, and crafts celebrating Washington's rich cultural heritage. More information on the festival is at WAMU.org under calendar. Our forecast for this afternoon, mostly cloudy skies, a 70% chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, lows overnight in the lower to mid-50s. Currently 78 degrees in Northwest Washington at 1244, as we return now to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
We're talking nanotechnology on this Tech Tuesday with Sean Murdoch, Executive Director of the Nano Business Alliance, Andrew Maynard, Chief Science Advisor to the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, and Vicky Colvin, Professor of Chemistry and Director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. We were talking about expectations earlier, and we got this email from Roger who says, "In medicine, I can imagine microscopic machines that will clean arteries, repair or replace broken neurons, etc. For example, some nanorotors could be injected into a clogged artery area, Then a catalyst chemical could be added to begin a biochemical reaction that activates the molecular motors that churn through arterial clogs. The motors could be quenched with another molecule that turns off the motor reactions. Thoughts, Vicki Colvin?
Well, I'm sorry my fire alarms are being tested today. But
even as we speak.
I'll make this fast. There's no nanotechnology thing going on here. No, that's a really interesting idea, and it kind of gets to this idea that folks had about really going from passive nanoparticles that just kind of sit there to being active materials that you can maybe trigger and turn on to do something, or that maybe go through two or three different states in response to their environment. And I think that's really the new way of what's happening as people make nanomaterials. So your caller's ideas are not totally out there. There are some nanoparticles now people are using for drug delivery that actually have the capability to go into a tumor, for example, and figure out what kind of tumor it is, arrange themselves to be the appropriate kind of drug, and then actually get triggered to release their payload by light that you shine in from the outside. So that kind of complexity and having that all happen on the nanoscale is really possible. The one caution is, you know, there's a tendency to kind of think in this Lilliputian world that everything that we know, like rotors, that works on our length scale is actually going to work on the nanoscale. And usually when you're designing materials down there, you might not actually make anything that looks like a rotor, because it might be more effective to have some sort of totally different kind of paradigm, like a balloon you inflate or something that looks really different that still gets this job done. So that would be the one caution, is that the materials that we're making down on those length scales have slightly different rules, and so some of the details can look a little different from what we're experienced with, but the end goals can be very important.
Back to the telephones. Here's George in Winchester, Virginia. George, your turn.
Yeah, how are you? Glad to be on the show, Kojo. Two-part question. First is, with all the new manufacturing, biomedical, and everything else going on, I'm wondering how patents, especially the U.S. Patent Office, is handling this. A lot of this stuff, I guess, is theoretical on the one hand, and then to some degree. And then the second part is, I'm wondering if the panelists know of the existence of a U.S. patent for the independent operability of nanotechnology, you know, getting into self-replication mode and stuff like that. And maybe they can answer whatever happened to the movie Prey, because I'm curious about that. Anyway.
Our listeners, I'm telling you, go right ahead, please. You want to start, Sean? Sean Murdoch? Oh,
Sean. The U.S. Patent Office has created a separate kind of cross-link category to track nanotechnology patents. Off the top of my head, the code 788, but whatever it may be, the U.S. Patent Office has, you know, created this meta category, if you will, to track all of the patent activity related to nanotechnology to make it easier to understand the developments that may have happened in heretofore disparate fields, and make sure that we're factoring in all the interdisciplinary science and knowledge when evaluating the patents. So they've done that. On the specific case of the second part of your question, I have no knowledge of that. I think it's fairly detailed, so I can't help you there.
The patent for independent operability, do you have any idea?
I have not seen anything like that. People quite often talk about self-replication with nanotechnology, the idea that you can make something at the nanoscale which also replicates, almost like artificial life. I don't think anybody's got anywhere near touching that with patents yet, but you never know. I could be proved wrong.
Thank you very much for your call, George. Andrew, it's my understanding that you feel, and you mentioned this earlier, but you didn't dwell on it, that a lot of the money that's being spent on nanotechnology is being spent on research and development, but that not a lot of money at this time is going towards safety studies.
I do feel that, and we've done a number of analyses here. So if you look at what the U.S. government is spending on nanotech research and development, it's around about $1.5 $1 billion a year. Now, if you try and work out how many projects are being funded that look specifically at how harmful some of these technologies might be and how to make them safe, certainly with my analysis, there's only about $15 million. It's just a drop in the ocean. Clearly, if you look at everything we need to know, if we're going to really take advantage of this technology and ensure its safety, I think there's got to be a lot more money there, but there's also got to be a clear idea of how we're going to spend that money.
There's Andrew in Rockville, Maryland. Andrew, did our Andrew Maynard just answer your question?
Somewhat, yeah. I was just sort of wondering, I interned at an environmental law firm called the ICTA, International Center for Technology Assessment in D.C. for a while. And I did a lot of research about nanotechnologies at the time. It was a couple of years ago, so I'm not sure what the developments since then have been. But at least at that time, really nobody had any information on what the effects were. And pretty much all the voices speaking out against it were just, you know, erring on the side of caution. I was wondering, basically just since then, if anybody has really made a significant point as to why we should be afraid of nanotechnology.
Andrew?
You know, first thing I would say is we shouldn't be afraid of nanotechnology. There's a lot of potential for good here. And I think things have changed over the last couple of years. We have seen a lot more research into working out how harm might be caused and how to avoid that. There's nowhere near enough. But the fact that we had this study come out looking at carbon nanotubes shows that people are beginning to ask the right questions and provide useful information. Hopefully, over the next few years, as we really see this technology begin to be commercialized, we'll have a lot more strategic research in this area, though.
Thank you very much for your call, Andrew. Sean, you were going to say something?
If I could just step in real quickly. We at the Nano Business Alliance have actually called for increased funding for environmental health safety research alongside environmental defense, Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, and others. It is important to note that the growth in the EHS research has been substantial. I know that the National Nanotechnology Initiative quotes about $75 million of EHS research that they hadn't proposed in FY 2009. But it has been growing dramatically, and that's because, you know, the technology is evolving. And early on, the research portfolio is necessarily more focused on fundamental science and you know, proving out some applications. And then as we understand how it's going to be used, the EHS research can and should grow. Again, that's, I guess, the first point. The second is it is important to understand with all this that we really are being proactive and forward-looking. The study that Andrew and the others did does not say in any way, shape, or form that multi-walled carbon nanotubes will be harmful to humans the way that asbestos was. It was talking about the potential toxicity of these nanotubes if they happen to get where we don't want them to go. And unfortunately, some people conflate, you know, hazard and risk and ultimately harm with risk. The carbon nanotubes, the global production is on the order of 3 tons right now. Asbestos was manufactured in million-ton quantities for 6 decades with almost no protective measures in the workplace. And now we're doing, you know, much, much less in mainly enclosed environment with personal protective equipment. And so we live in a very different world right now that really does look and ask the question, what could go wrong, so that we study it and make sure that we take action in a timely fashion.
We got this email from Nagesh in Washington who writes, what real significant difference would there actually be between products now produced by nanotechnology compared to that of the decades of technology already fabricated via microtechnology? Both are pretty darn small ranges. Vicki Colvin?
Well, I think one important thing is, first of all, it's a microtechnology. It actually can be called nanotechnology. It's just a top-down fabrication. You're making it with lithography, carving silicon or other substances away. So in some sense, it is a cousin of microtechnology. But I think probably the important thing, you know, to realize if you look at things like carbon black or a lot of the catalysts that we use even today that were developed decades ago, is that most of modern nanotechnology is able to construct the matter with very precise atomic positioning. It's kind of like the difference between, you know, your three-year-old getting a big ball of Play-Doh and making a ball out of it versus your, you know, eight-year-old who's got some intricate Lego set and they're making a ball with, you know, precisely defined, you know, pieces. And I think that may be the difference, is that maybe both at the end of the day are still small, but the one that's a lot more molecular and defined has a lot more functionality. So that's really the modern nanotechnology, although he's right. You know, at some level, if we're only using size to define it, there's a lot of stuff that's small that human beings have been making, you know, heck, for centuries in some cases.
Here's Barbara. Sorry. Go ahead, Sean.
It's important that it's not just smaller, to be honest. When you look at the solar cells, for example, what's important there is that we're literally engineering these nanomaterials so that they absorb more energy spectrum and, of the light and convert it to electricity more effectively. So it's not just about smaller. It is about engineering the materials to get more. And that's where you see big differences both there and I think in the biological applications in drug delivery, for example. It is qualitatively different.
Here's Barbara in Annapolis, Maryland. Barbara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I wanted to ask your panelists, Sean in particular, he's familiar with the disease Morgellons and the research that's been done that traces Morgellons to the long carbon form nanotubes that's been done by Dr. Hildegard Staniger, and the fact that there are probably over 400 people in the United States that have this disease right now, and that the NIH has just instituted a clinical trial looking at the relationship of carbon nanotubes to Morgellons.
You wanted to ask Sean about that?
Yes.
Okay, Sean, go ahead, please.
I'm certainly not familiar with that study. Where was that study published?
It hasn't been published. It's just begun.
Oh, it's just beginning. Have you heard anything about it at all, Andrew?
No, I haven't. I know that people have been concerned about what causes Morgellons and looking at the possibility of different engineered nanomaterials and other nanomaterials as well being associated with it. These are really speculative associations, and although it's good that the NIH are beginning to look at this, we really don't know where this research is going at the moment.
Barbara, thank you very much for your call. We're almost out of time, but one idea that I find particularly fascinating is that of nanofood. I've read that scientists are looking at how nanoparticles can be used to help vegetables retain vitamins or to make fatty foods more healthy. Where does the research on nanofoods stand, Vicky Colvin, and when can I expect some on my nano plate?
Well, you know, I actually think that there may already be some nanomaterials in use in food, certainly in packaging. Yeah, we can all hope for better nutrition as the food prices start to climb. It may see a better market for it. I think that it's one of those, I'll call it a sleeper area of nanotechnology, in the sense that when all of us, when nanotech got its most hype probably in the 1990s, it was all about making better computers. And I think, in quietly our consumer products companies and others were finding ways of using better engineered materials generally, and sometimes nanomaterials, to kind of make our everyday lives.
I'm afraid we're just about out of time right now, but I'll be looking forward to my nano food at some point in the future. Vicky Colvin is a professor of chemistry and director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. Sean Murdoch is executive director of the Nano Business Alliance, which represents nanotech businesses on Capitol Hill and Wall Street. And Andrew Maynard is chief science advisor to the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, which is dedicated to minimizing the risks and maximizing the potential benefits of nanotechnology. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey, and you're listening to WAMU 88.5. The second hour of today's Kojo Nandi show is coming up next. Then at 2 o'clock, stay with us for Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
We take lessons if we want to play better tennis or golf or the piano, but what if we want to be better parents?
Usually, I didn't have a lot of black friends to ask, and you can't ask a white mother how to raise your black son.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join me and the Mocha Moms as we talk about parent education programs.